So, how do you remember being in England?
I mean, it seems so long ago now, but
yeah,
it's
now mid-July.
We've been back for just over 2 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I'm just gonna first of all say welcome to the Tipsy Archives.
Hello.
I am Rachel Leagy,
and I am Erin Redekop.
And we're just going to quickly do the last installment of our European Two Awkward Girls in Europe 2017 trip.
Woohoo!
Installments?
Yeah.
Or something?
Oh my god, it's the final one. It kind of makes me sad. It's like the trip's really over now.
It's the first time I'd really thought about it that vividly.
Yeah.
Since, for the last little while, since coming back. We talked about every place we'd been. Except for our last couple of days in England and Canterbury. So we thought, you know, to bring a close to everything, we should definitely talk about our experience there.
We are concluding our trip now.
Cool. So we left Budapest, where you had lost your phone.
Lost my phone, had my entertaining discussion with the British person in front of us in the line.
Yeah, well, we talked about in the last one how I was kind of saying, we should go to the National Gallery in London. And Erin and her tired crankiness was like, ugh, the National Gallery.
What's even there?
I don't even care. And then some British guy in front of us was like, oh my god, it's amazing.
Which it was.
It was.
It was really great. But we're not quite there yet.
But so we had to spend a couple days in London before flying back to Canada. And I think we both sort of felt like we had done a bit of London when we first flew in.
Yeah.
It is so expensive.
We both been to London before. No, you hadn't been to London.
No, I had.
Oh, you had.
A couple times.
We'd both been to London a couple of times before, so we were like, we don't need to stay here for that long.
Yeah, and I think at that point we've been traveling for 3 weeks, so we wanted to do something a little bit more relaxing and a little bit nicer, so we decided to take a day trip or plan a day trip outside of London to go see something different that we hadn't seen.
Yeah, and we were trying to decide between going out to, where was it, Canterbury,
Bath,
and Windsor Castle was the other, because Rachel and I are strong monarchists, so I think we've mentioned that many times now.
I did spend some time looking at really overpriced day trips out to Highclere Castle.
Oh, yeah, we wanted to do the Downton Abbey tour.
It was very tempting.
I know, it's like $900 in the end.
No, it wasn't that much.
I think for both of us it was going to be $900 or something like
it was,
that.
Yeah, it was a few $100s.
Yeah, or maybe it was $300. But
it was like £200 or £300. I don't remember, but it was
a big number that we didn't want to spend.
It was more than we wanted to spend for sure, but we certainly considered it.
Day we were in London for the first day that we were there, and so we went out to the National Gallery, which we'll talk about in a minute. But we also discovered we were staying next to King's Cross Station, and so then we discovered the Harry Potter store in King's Cross. And I think when we realized how much stuff we wanted to buy in the Harry Potter store, that we were like, okay, we can't go to the Downton. We can be Downton Abbey fans, or we can be Harry Potter fans, and Harry Potter won out for us.
The funny thing was, is Erin showed me where the store was, and I had no, like, I haven't, I do love Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I've read the first couple books, but I have not read all of them. I did not realize that there was a Harry Potter connection to King's Cross.
So Rachel was actually, I was like, okay, we have to go to platform 9 3/4. And she's like, but that means we're going to have to go all the way inside. And I was like, no, like there's platform 9 3/4 display set up. And she didn't quite get it the entire time I'm describing it. She's like, okay, whatever, Erin. And then I took her inside and I'm like, look, it's right there where that giant lineup is. And
yeah, and then there's this whole store of Harry Potter memorabilia. And when we did finally go there, I said to Erin, I was like, okay, I'm not letting myself spend more than £100, which is like over $200.
And you spent £99.98.
Really, I figured out all the things. Because to be fair, I was shopping for my sister and my nephew and my friends and myself.
Yeah.
So I bought a lot of things for the people in my life that love Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And I went up to the till and it was like, £98.50 or something.
It was something like that.
Perfect.
Yeah. It was great.
And it all worked out.
But as soon as we saw how much the Harry Potter store was going to cost us, we were like, okay, not going on the Downton Abbey trip.
But so we did decide to go to Canterbury for the day. We did some research and found that it, you know, it looked very lovely and had a nice cathedral, and that you could get there in, I think, an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah, and I think it cost us like £12 to go or something like that.
It wasn't much.
Yeah, it was really affordable for us to go out to Canterbury.
And at that point in the trip, I just kind of wanted to do the thing that felt easiest and relaxing, but still, like, enjoyable.
And it was a direct train, so yeah it was perfectly easy.
So, we did go to the National Gallery in London.
Yeah.
And saw, and to be fair, we hadn't been to a really good gallery in a couple of weeks, because after Paris, I mean, there wasn't, we did go to the Mucha Museum in Prague,
but
in Slovenia and Budapest, we didn't really do.
It was more museums and, like, cultural experiences when we were in those places. It wasn't a gallery, and so we hadn't been to a gallery since Paris.
Yeah, and the National Gallery certainly has some really wonderful pieces.
When I walked in and I immediately got the map, and I was like, oh, there is really good stuff here. Yeah. Rachel was like, what did you think I was trying to drag you to? Yeah.
I'm like, look, Da Vinci's.
I was really embarrassed, actually, by the time we got home, and my mom was like, Erin, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, I don't know, I was tired, leave me alone. So,
I remember the first time I went to the National Gallery was 9 years ago, and it was like I was in London for a day, and I was trying to pack in all this stuff, and I had been lugging around my giant backpack, and I didn't know as much about art back then, and I had been there, but my memories of being there, I'm like super exhausted and overwhelmed.
Yeah.
But I remember really enjoying it, so it was nice to go back and like not have a backpack and relax and kind of like, and as you and I have talked about a number of times through the trip, like, we've learned that going to these amazing museums and galleries is not about stopping to look at every single painting for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's about breezing through and finding some of your favorites and really enjoying those and then moving on, because you can't appreciate every single thing or you get completely burnt out.
You do. And like the one day that I tried to do that in Berlin, when I was in Berlin in the fall, I was just like, I hate museums by the end of this. And I don't really remember a lot of them. Like, I don't even remember the first museum I was in when I was in Berlin, because it all sort of blends into one.
And I think one really awesome thing on this trip for you and I was, not only did I get to see some great paintings that I had written about in art history classes, but you and I got to see some great paintings that we've talked about.
Yeah, that was the most exciting part.
So, we found the Rokeby Venus by Diego Velázquez. So we found that painting in the National Gallery, and that was cool because we had talked about that in our Art Destruction episode.
Yeah.
I found a Holbein painting that I love of the two ambassadors.
Yeah, you found that one. I think I talked about this when we were talking about our Paris episode about the Louvre, is Madonna on the Rocks at the Louvre. I've always said it's my favorite painting. But there is the Virgin on the Rocks that is a different version of it. And we saw that in the National Gallery. And it was incredible to see them both on the same trip.
Totally.
And like just 2 weeks apart, because I could see the little subtle differences. So I've now come to the decision that the sky in the back of Virgin on the Rocks, which is in London, is the best, is my favorite. Like,
which one's
background,
the one that's much darker?
Darker is the one in Paris. That's Madonna on the Rocks.
Right.
But I love that one because there's the idea of the angel, the way she's holding her finger looks like she's saying to slit somebody's throat.
Because Madonna's hand is out like she's holding a head.
Yeah. And so it's like slitting a throat.
I wonder if that's like total conspiracy
theory. Oh, it can totally be that.
Yeah.
And there's so much conspiracy around.
That you would have heard about if you had read Dan Brown.
Oh, Dan Brown.
Da Vinci Code.
But
which is totally fun art smut.
Oh, it's so much fun art smut. Speaking of that, I'm reading the one you were reading when we were in Paris, the Sacre Bleu. It's so much fun.
It is really fun.
It's really fun. Mm-hmm. It's totally
I'm still reading
fun.
It because I'm the slowest reader.
I'm about halfway through and it's not the quickest book, but it's fun. Mm-hmm. But to go back, so I got to see that. And it was really interesting sort of realizing like which parts of which painting I liked, the way they fit together. Mm-hmm. And there is some talk that the one that's in the National Gallery in London is done by an apprentice. And you can sort of see that. There's differences, but...
I mean, it was so common at that time to have artists to have their whole workshops, right?
Yeah.
So, like, they would have done, you know, 60% of the painting and then had their students do the background or the cloth or something.
Yeah, or, like, fill in the little bits of color.
So you don't know often, especially when you look at frescoes and murals, like, how common is it for an artist to actually do everything himself? Not very common.
No, especially not with these grand masterpieces, yeah. Right? And, like, especially, like, when you think about people who are designing, like, these giant buildings. Like, I'm thinking of the one in Barcelona by the artist that got hit by a car, and so he never got to see
it. Oh, Gaudi.
Gaudi, yeah. It's, like...
the Sagrada Familia.
Yeah, and so, like, obviously, like, he's designed that, but... he didn't do everything in there.
And it's continued on for decades and decades after his death.
Exactly. Yet it's still
not done.
But it's still Gaudi. Like, it's still considered his work. And so even if part of Madonna on the Rocks is done by apprentices, it's still, in my mind, a Da Vinci.
Mm-hmm.
But it was lovely to see that piece up front. I got a couple of prints of it, too, so that I can have one in my office, one in my home. What else? Oh, the Van Eyck painting that's got the reflection. And so it's like the pregnant woman and the
husband. She's actually not pregnant.
She's not pregnant.
No, it's the one, it's a Dutch couple and they're kind of standing there holding hands. It's a marriage portrait.
Oh, because she looks very pregnant.
She does, but it's the style of dress at the time.
Oh.
And she's not actually pregnant because it's their wedding.
Oh.
They haven't, they've either just been married or they maybe haven't slept together yet.
So in
the, if you've seen the piece, I don't actually, it's called The Portrait of some name that's really Dutch and I don't remember what
it is.
The guy kind of looks like Putin.
Yeah, he does.
He kind of looks totally like... does. There's a little dog in it and that's a symbol for fidelity. And then the woman, they're sort of holding hands and she's got her hand on her stomach and the dress is really bunched up around the stomach.
So it looks like she's got her hand as if she's got a belly.
But it's the style of the dress and it's the pose, but she's not actually supposed to be pregnant.
Interesting, because I always just looked at it with the way her hand is on her belly.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, a couple awaiting their first child. Like, that's the way I looked at it.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. And, well, when I studied it, I don't think we ever really studied the people in it. It was all about the reflection, because the way that one works, or the way it, when you see it, is it's a whole bunch of reflections. And so it goes back and back and back and back and back.
But you can see Van Eyck in the reflection of the mirror, and then there's this writing on the wall. It's actually kind of Escher-esque.
Yeah. I really like that painting. Not necessarily because of the couple, because the couple isn't, like, overly visually appealing in its of itself, but it's just the art and, like, the intricacies of the mirror.
The weird domestic setting and all the symbolism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, so there's definitely a number of... I really enjoyed the Madame de Pompadour...
Oh.
Figgy
LeBrun one?
Yeah, Elizabeth Vigée LeBrun.
Yeah.
Stuff. I really enjoyed that. Sort of Enlightenment Rococo. Oh, man, I just had a pang of regretting dropping that Art of Enlightenment class that I just dropped.
Damn it. So that was pretty much it for the National Gallery, I think.
I have such a soft spot for Vigée LeBrun because she is a woman.
Yes.
During that period of time of the late 1700s. Yeah, that's right. Late 1700s.
Yeah.
And I don't know, just like she didn't have a great life or anything, but she cozied up to a lot of royalty, but still kind of like didn't let it go to her head and just seemed like a really good person who was really motivated by being a good artist and managed to get out of the revolution unscathed.
Yeah, she didn't lose her head.
Yeah. Exactly.
It was funny, because I was talking to a friend of ours about her once we got back, because it was in the trivia contest, or in the trivia league, and I couldn't remember what museum we'd seen her at, and so I was like, was it, like...
Well, she was in the Louvre as well.
She was in the Louvre, but I couldn't remember if it was the Victoria and Albert, or if it was the National Gallery, or if it was the train station one in Paris, D'Orsay, Musée d'Orsay. Yeah.
She's definitely in the Louvre. She would not have been in Orsay because the time period's not right.
No.
it's possible that she was in Victoria and Albert, but she was definitely in the Louvre, and she was definitely in the National Gallery.
Well, we saw the picture that we took of her.
Yeah, recently. Especially the Madame de Pompadour, who I would love to do a podcast about, because she is a really cool lady.
I love Madame de Pompadour.
Yeah. I mean, talk about a feminist.
Okay, so we're committing to doing that now. Well, we both love her, so.
Yeah. But we should move on.
We should, because we haven't got to Canterbury yet.
Yeah, but so... Let's talk about Canterbury. We took the train out.
We took the train out. And
we got there, and, like, it's a short little walk into town, and pretty much right away we were like, this is adorable and lovely.
The number of times I said to Rachel, I live here now.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, yep, let's move here.
We kept looking. So they have all of this housing for rent there, because it is a university town.
Yeah, we kept walking back by all these little real estate places that had all these, like, for rent, for sale.
And they were like, only for students. And I was like, well, we could become students.
I am a student.
You are a student. Yeah. I could become a student easily, and then we could just live there. And yeah. It would have been great. We took a little bit of a scenic walk into town, too. We went down the river. There was all this punting going on.
Which is like these little, it was like a shallow rowboat sort of deal.
And this dude, like, it's sort of like a guy in a
almost
gondola.
Like a gondola, yeah.
And so he pushes you down the river. I did it in Oxford and Cambridge when I was there, like, 15 years ago.
So in keeping with the theme of our trip, you know, a city on a river.
Yeah, city on a river.
So this one, from what I found, was just called the River Midway. I read that it was a very popular place for Vikings in the 8th century. They would travel up and down the river quite often.
That makes sense.
One thing that I found out about the area is that even though, like, it was originally different smaller villages, but now, you know, Canterbury is a larger city that engulfs both sides of the river. But if you are from north of the river, you are called a Kentish man or woman.
Okay.
But if you're from the south of the river, you are a man from Kent or a woman from Kent.
That's really interesting.
And there's a difference between being a Kentish man and a man from Kent.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of funny. So, and then Kent would be like the region.
Yeah, Kent's the region.
Yeah.
I like that. Well, and that also makes sense, too, because the river runs just outside the city gates.
Yeah, there's a very definitive, you know, like, this is the gate you are now walking into the little town of Canterbury, which is on the right on the edge of the river.
Yeah.
We went and, actually, I just remembered this right now, that we went and kind of walked by that old... very old ruined castle, which I didn't look up any information for.
I didn't look up any information, but I was talking to my parents when I got back from the trip, because my parents love Canterbury. That was one of the reasons that we decided to go, is my dad's rave reviews on Canterbury. And so the old church that we saw when we were coming in, the old ruins, you couldn't go anywhere near. They were all closed off. Mm-hmm. And my dad was saying when he went that he could just walk in amongst them. And he said it was like one of the coolest things he's done.
Yeah, I mean, and that must have been, gosh, like, very early medieval.
Oh, yeah.
You know, probably 12th, 13th century or something. I'm taking a total stab at that, but, like, maybe older. Maybe, I don't even know.
It was really old. It's really old.
Because Christianity hit the UK, gosh, I want to say... 400,
yeah,
500.
Yeah, because it's, what, 300 in Rome, so...
It took 100 or 2 years to get over to the British Isles.
Yeah.
And then it kind of took a slow path for it to really build up to everybody being a Christian. But, like, churches started popping up in the 5th, 6th century.
Yeah, and I would say that that church was probably around the 600s.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was crazy ruins, and... But, yeah, my dad was saying my parents went in, I think, like, 1991 when they went to Canterbury.
Back when you could just walk around ruins.
And, you know. Well, yeah, they were able to walk around Stonehenge.
Cool. So, I mean, of course, one of the biggest attractions of Canterbury is the fact that it has a cathedral.
It's a beautiful cathedral.
And it is one of the most important cathedrals, if not the most important cathedral in, you know, English religion, because it was one of the very early, I want to say possibly even the first actual physical cathedral in England, because it was the first Roman Catholic church to be the seat of a bishop.
Is it older than Salisbury?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, then, yeah, then it is. Then
yeah,
it
is. Because, yeah. So, Augustine, so now St. Augustine, was sent over in the late 6th century by Pope Gregory the Great to go and Christianize more of, at this point, it wouldn't even have been called England.
Yeah, it would have been, like, Britannia.
I don't even know.
Yeah, we haven't even got to the Battle of Hastings yet.
Yeah, like, so this is very early on in, like, this is a lot of sort of, like, warring, like, Anglo-Saxon groups and, you know, like, even, like, very early on Danish Viking stuff. Like, it's long time ago, but Christianity has started to pop up in a few small places due to missionaries. The Pope Gregory sends Augustine over to make an official church. And King Ethelbert and Queen Bertha, which is these great names.
I love it.
I believe Queen Bertha was French. They were Christians, and so they welcomed St. Augustine, and they set up, they either gave him this church or they arranged for him this church to be built. And so he was kind of the first bishop appointed by the Pope in England.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had, like, this seat in England. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was the first actual cathedral, officially, because cathedral means seat of a bishop or the seat of the church.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it was a big deal then. And then hundreds of years go by, the English church, of course, goes through the Reformation and they become the Anglican Church of England.
Yeah.
And now, Canterbury Cathedral is the seat of the Anglican Archbishop, who is now, I have it written
Archbishop
down.
Archbishop Welby.
Yeah, Justin Welby.
Which is actually a funny story. So I have these friends that whenever we go on vacation, we send each other the most boring postcards in the world. And so I found a postcard of Archbishop Welby. And, like, he looks like a very boring person. So I sent it to them.
Apparently he loves sailing.
He loves it. Well, that was the other thing. And so I sent it to my friend and he's just like, Aaron, he's not boring at all.
Course,
and he's just like,
he said that.
And so he gets so excited and he's starting to tell me all of this. And he's like, can't believe you thought this was the boring postcard.
It was boring because it was just a picture of his face.
Dude. Like, and that's... he's like, no, the other postcard was the boring postcard. This is not the boring postcard. And just like goes off and tells me every single thing that there is to, like, know about.
It's actually difficult to find boring postcards, as I found out sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Well, because I spent the whole time searching for a boring postcard.
I just want to take a moment to emphasize again how fucking adorable this town is.
Oh, it was so cute. The river
and
is,
like,
so cute.
Medieval and English and cute.
Also, it had incredible signage. And, like, yes. After coming from, like, Prague and...
And you being in Brussels.
And me being in Brussels and... Even Budapest wasn't great for signage, but...
This place, it was like, everywhere you went was like, this church is this way, this church is this way, this is north, this is where you are. Like,
here's the scenic route.
So easy to find your way around.
I know, and it would update you as you were going to, and it'd be like, still on the right track, and you're like, woohoo! Like, we were just so happy with that.
It just made being there really relaxing.
Oh, I think that day was probably the most relaxing day of our trip.
After 3 weeks of traveling, we were just like, this is enjoyable and scenic and beautiful, and everyone speaks English, and there's signs everywhere, and we love it.
And everybody was so nice to us. I bought the most amazing lip gloss in Canterbury Cathedral.
Yeah.
So I got a nun, an archbishop, and a priest lip gloss.
I loved that.
I know. They only had one left, so Rachel couldn't get a set, but I was just like, I'm getting this.
So, we went to the cathedral, of course, that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
It was, unfortunately, under quite a bit of scaffolding.
So, we didn't get to see it, because, like, apparently, and we saw a little bit about the fan vaulting at Canterbury Cathedral is apparently the best in the world.
I don't know, the fan vaulting in the Lady Chapel at Westminster Abbey is pretty fucking amazing.
I know, I love
that. I actually
that.
Wrote a paper about it.
No, you're right. And I think the fan vaulting at Westminster Abbey...
Wow, I am a nerd.
Yeah, I mean, my mom wrote a thesis just on the rose window at
Notre
Dame.
God. How are you and your mom and me not friends?
Because you have tattoos, Rachel.
She'll get over it. I'm super fucking charming.
Can I get a Rose Window tattoo?
Yes!
Yeah! Oh, I have the tattoo bank. That's what I want next.
Yeah. Yeah. So I owed Erin a little bit of money after the trip, and I just said, how about I just tattoo you?
Yeah.
Because that's my job.
And I was like, that's cool, that's expensive, and I probably wouldn't do it otherwise. Since
I don't have any money.
And so that's what we've been doing. Yay, Harry Potter!
I gave Erin her first tattoo
when we got back,
and it's a cathedral window-style Harry Potter tattoo.
It's amazing, and feminist, because it's about smashing the patriarchy.
Yeah.
So it's the best thing in the world, and I love it, and I keep looking at it. I see, I really like it, because even when I wear short sleeves, it just peeks out.
And it looks like a cross.
Yeah.
Sexy.
It's so great. I love this tattoo. Anyway, so now I have a tattoo bank with Rigel, where I just sort of, for X amount of time until I run it out, I get to be like, Rachel, I want this.
I was just saying the other day, I need to do more stained glass window tattoos.
I want a stained glass.
Like, literally.
Well, let's get me a stained glass window tattoo.
And me.
Let's get matching ones.
Yeah. So, speaking of stained glass windows.
There's a lot of them there.
Yeah, Canterbury Cathedral, even though there was quite a bit of scaffolding on the outside and some on the inside, so we didn't get to see the entire roof in its full glory. We still definitely got to see a lot of it, and it was beautiful. I mean, it's in a lot of ways a typical cathedral with its basilica cross shape and everything, but they had some beautiful cloisters.
Yeah.
With a lot of really nice stained glass in that area as well.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember if there's, like, a lot that necessarily stands out other than awe-inspiring tall ceilings and beautifulness.
I don't think there was anything really epic about the stained glass. I mean, the thing that is really big about Canterbury Cathedral, outside of, like, being the first, is that it was the place of the murder of Thomas Becket.
Right, yes. This is very important.
This is very important. So, Thomas Becket, who is now St. Thomas Becket, he was the Archbishop of Canterbury. This was back in the 1100s.
So, I mean, you have to start out by saying that. So this is King Henry II.
King Henry II, yeah.
And Thomas Becket happened to be good friends with King Henry II.
They were best friends. Like if it were modern day, they'd be besties, and they'd have a lot of selfies together.
So Thomas Becket was not a trained priest.
No.
But he was a very pious man.
Yeah.
So he's very religious.
He was very devoted.
He took it very personally.
Mm-hmm. Very seriously.
But he was not, he'd not necessarily worked his way up through the clergy.
Mm-hmm.
But Henry made him the Archbishop of the church.
Yeah.
Back when this was still Roman Catholic times. Which, you know, to be honest, didn't seem like a terrible move, because it seemed like Thomas Becket did a really good job, even though he hadn't necessarily worked his way up.
No, because he was a very pious man, and mm-hmm. because he was very devoted, he did a lot of research. And he prayed a lot. He was very devoted to his faith. And so, even though he had not done the full workup, he still had a lot of the, like, the training that you would have to be a very pious individual.
Ah, so this is Henry II, who's married to Eleanor of Aquitaine.
It is.
Okay.
We love our Eleanor. We also are going to do a podcast with Eleanor.
One day I'm going to have to go through all the podcasts and write down all the things we've talked about we're going to do episodes about. But we love Eleanor of Aquitaine.
She's the great... Well, when you come in to smash the patriarchy, Eleanor is one of the first.
There's not a lot of, like, badass female figures in medieval times.
Yeah, and
she's one of the most badass.
Yeah.
I mean, who, like, leaves their husband because they decide they don't really like him and moves to another country?
Yep.
Yeah, she did that.
When she went on crusades, not by herself, but, like, without Henry, she went on crusades.
Yeah. And she was, like, the matriarch of that family after he died. But, so, anyway, this is the... I just had this moment where I thought, like, I feel like this guy is connected to Eleanor, and he is.
He was married to Henry.
So, they are really the beginners of the Plantagenet line. So that's who we're talking about. So, anyway, Thomas Becket and Henry, even though they're friends, didn't always see eye to eye. They're both seemed to be very strong-willed, stubborn people.
Yeah, and they would disagree, especially because I mean, and it actually gets into sort of the beginnings of why there should be a separation between church and state, is because Becket would see things very much along the church line, and Henry II would sort of see it along that line, but also about how it would help to improve, like, how making somebody a Catholic or giving somebody a position would strengthen his kingdom.
So it's very political.
Yeah, it's like political versus
chess.
Yeah, and so it really, to me, is sort of the definition of why those need to be separated.
True. Yeah, so I guess at some point, Henry has some disagreements with Thomas, and he seemed, as the story goes, he exclaims, you know, "Who will rid me of this turbulent priest?" And they're friends, and he was frustrated, and he seems to have not necessarily meant it.
Yeah.
But he was overheard saying this, and four knights took it upon themselves to go into the church, find Archbishop Becket, and cut him down.
Well, he's praying, nonetheless. Yeah. And so there's this area of the church that is devoted to the monument of Thomas Becket, or the martyrdom of Thomas Becket, because he was cut down while praying.
And needless to say, King Henry felt pretty crappy about that.
Yeah, well, and he's just devastated about it because it was his friend. I can't remember if he did anything to the knights that killed him, but he was just absolutely devastated. The Lion in Winter, which is a movie about Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine, and it's...
Ooh, I need to watch that.
It's so good. We should watch it. I can't remember who plays Henry II, but Eleanor of Aquitaine is Katharine Hepburn.
Right.
And they talk about that still. Like, it's more about their children and their marriage, but they talk about how he's never been the same since that day, and I really... Thomas Becket is a... Apparently the movie Becket is supposed to be very good.
Peter O'Toole.
Ah.
And apparently Anthony Hopkins. A very young Anthony Hopkins.
Who's he? Oh, he's Richard. Richard. Yeah, he is Richard the Lionheart.
Yeah, I would really like to see that movie.
It's set after... So they've got... They have Henry, Richard, and John.
Mm-hmm.
And because, like, their child is John, like, Magna Carta John.
Well, that's what, when you were saying, like, this is the beginning of the separation of church and state, I thought, like, wasn't it's their son that has the Magna Carta.
Yeah, and so that's essentially part of what it's about. So Henry has died, now they have Richard, and then they're discussing about how much they don't like John.
Oh, John, you're such a fuck-up. There should be, like, a Netflix for, like, just old movies.
Yeah, it would be so good.
Because it can't cost that much to get the rights to these kinds of things.
And Lion in Winter is so good. Like, it's black and white. It's brilliant. To be fair, I could just watch Katharine Hepburn movies all the time, and I'd be super happy.
She's pretty fantastic.
I love her. Yeah.
So, I mean, anything else to add about the Thomas Becket thing? I know that your dad is a big fan.
My dad's a huge fan. Part of the reason why I wanted to go to Canterbury has just, like... So my parents love Canterbury, my dad especially. And since my parents got back...
It is also a World Heritage Site.
I have now been to quite a few of them, I guess. But yeah, so we went... my dad is a huge fan. Since they went to London for the first time in the 90s, my dad came home and he was like, it's the place where you feel something. Like, you feel when you walk in.
I feel like in Canterbury, because of how old it feels...
Yeah.
Like, you really get a sense of what it would have been to be like there, what it would have been like to be there 500 years ago.
Yeah.
Because it still seems so medieval and so old school. And, like, obviously there are modern changes, but so much of it hasn't changed.
Yeah, it's not like when you go to a city, like, because we went to a number of them.
London and you see things that are old, but then next to it you see something super modern.
Yeah. Well, and it's why, like, I like going out to those small towns when I'm in England. And so that's what I felt like when I went to Oxford and Cambridge, too, is it's old. And this is the thing I loved. So when I went to Belgium in October, my favorite place that we went to was a university town as well, Ghent, because it is tiny and quaint and everything feels old and you feel like you were back in the times.
I mean, and maybe this novelty is only there for us because we're Canadian and we we live in modern cities, and maybe the people that live there are just like, oh god, this shit is old and lame, and I can't wait to move to like buildings that have better plumbing. Like, maybe it's just novel to us, but like, to me, when I go to places like this, I'm like, oh, like I can really feel or can imagine what it would have been like.
Well, and I can see a bit of what you were saying about how people like, maybe I just want to move to a like newer place with better plumbing, because even so, I used to work at the Vancouver Art Gallery, and I mean, it's one of the older buildings in Vancouver. It's not anywhere near as old as the places we were seeing. But every day when I would walk to work and I'd walk through the plaza and I'd see it and I'd look at it and I was like, I'm so excited that I work in this building. Mm-hmm. And then like you get inside and you're like, I just want a place where Wi-Fi works better. I just want a place mm-hmm. where I know I can trust the plumbing. I just don't want to ride this elevator that I'm worried is going to like break down every second. And so it's interesting. It's actually where I discovered that the best thing you can do is live across the street from an old building.
So that you can like go visit it
and then look at it and that's your view out your window, but you have your like modern fixtures that you live in.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they both really have their pros and cons.
Well, there's a lot of maintenance that goes into old stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, if we're going to talk about going to Canterbury...
There's a thing that happens in Canterbury.
We have to talk about the thing that I'm sure most people, when you hear the word Canterbury, think of, which is The Canterbury Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer.
And that really fits into what we were just talking about with Thomas Becket, is because I didn't know too much about Canterbury Tales. Did you know much about before we went on it?
A little from like school, but not a ton. I mean, I knew that it was a bunch of stories about people on a pilgrimage.
But I didn't even realize. So it's the pilgrimage to visit Thomas Becket's grave.
So, yeah, really after he was martyred is when it became more of a site for that kind of thing. And I think pilgrimages in general became more sort of common and of fashion in that period of time, which is a bit more like the 14th and 15th century.
Yeah.
Which would be like a couple hundred years after Thomas Becket has been martyred.
Mm-hmm.
So, Geoffrey Chaucer is the author, and I just, first off the bat, have to say that a lot of my early introduction to Geoffrey Chaucer was by the very handsome Paul Bettany in A Knight's Tale.
Ooh, yes. I'm a big fan of
A very fictional account, but I very much enjoyed his fictional, handsome, naked Geoffrey Chaucer.
I can't rewatch A Knight's Tale.
But yeah, so he wrote this story, which was originally written in Middle English. It is a combination of poetry and prose, written somewhere between 1386 and 1395.
And if you tell me that you've read every line of it, I'm going to either call you a liar or be very impressed.
Okay. So the one interesting thing I found out when I was researching is that it wasn't published for, I don't know, decades or close to 100 years after it was actually written. Obviously because the printing press wasn't invented yet.
Yes.
When it was written. But, like, the first number of copies were just handwritten, hand-copied manuscripts that circulated around the area.
Was it a bit more of an oral tradition than with Canterbury Tales, or?
Well, I found that it was hand-circulated manuscripts.
Okay.
So it was written and rewritten, and probably then, you know, there'd be, like, a person who could read, who would tell the stories to people, and then maybe they would pass it on. So I'm sure it was a combination of both, because during that time, most common people weren't reading.
Mm-hmm.
But he did write it in the late 14th century, and it wasn't published until the 15th century, so there was definitely a period of time before it was actually a printed book.
Right.
So the narrator of the book is an anonymous pilgrim on this pilgrimage. I'm not 100% sure where they leave from, but they are heading towards Canterbury.
Yeah.
And it's a number of stories by people on the pilgrimage, and there's a... you know, like an old widow and a cleric.
There's a drunk.
There's a drunk guy... like a knight.
a knight, a priest.
Yeah, there's just all these people who, along the road on their way to Canterbury, you know, they stop and they share a tale or a story. And sometimes it's humorous. I mean, it's often humorous and satirical, but there are also, like, ones that are a bit more serious and pious. And
yeah.
So it's kind of all, it's sort of like, and the really cool thing about Canterbury Tales is it's so slice of life.
Yeah.
For that period of time, and so much of the writings that we have from, you know, medieval writings focus on people who are, like, royalty.
Yeah.
So that's the really cool thing about that, is that we get to hear about, like, what's life like for a priest, what's life like for a peasant.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for that reason, it's an extremely valued piece of literature.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I, you know, I did a little bit of research online and found that there was a, gosh, what would you call it? A, not a museum or a site, a...
attraction.
An attraction. That's the perfect word for it.
Yeah.
There's an attraction called the Canterbury Tales.
And it was in an old church.
Yeah, that I think at one point been burnt down and then rebuilt or
yeah,
something.
It was like the Church of Magdalene or something like
I
that.
I want to say Margaret.
It started with an M.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was not far from the cathedral.
And so we had some time to kill, and it wasn't very expensive, and we decided to go check out this Canterbury Tales attraction.
Yeah.
And it was really cool, and I didn't know a lot about Canterbury Tales, like the very kind of bare minimum.
Yeah.
And it was a really cool way to find out more about it. And we went in, and you
got the, like, earpieces that you get in a lot of museums.
Yeah.
But you're met by these people in costume.
Yeah.
And they start talking to you in accents, and they're like, welcome to your pilgrimage. And, like, everything's very, like, in character. Everything's in character.
The other day, we happened to walk in, like, at the perfect moment. Because they were like...
Yeah.
Because it seemed like they do it in tours.
Yeah. Yeah, they have to do it in tours.
It was, like, once an hour or once every half an hour or something.
Yeah. And
we walked in, and we paid the thing, and they were like, we're leaving on a tour right now. And it just worked out perfectly. We were with... like, four or five other people.
Yeah, well, because this is, like, May in...
Yeah.
In Canterbury, so it's not busy.
So we have this very friendly guy being like, welcome to Canterbury, here's your earpiece, and go ahead. And you walk into this room, and an actress comes out, and this, like, she's got this heavy, like, you know... Middle English, like, lower English kind of accent.
Yeah, it's, like, what you would expect your, like... your
peasant
or, like, you know, the chambermaid, mm-hmm. to the accent that they would have.
Yeah, and you're, like, in a stable, and she's playing it up, like, you know, oh, have some of this food, it's maybe kind of rotten, and like I'm not even going to attempt to do the accent, because that would just,
oh, yeah,
would just
she
embarrass
was
myself.
So good, yeah.
I mean, you can tell this, like, these people are actors.
Yeah.
It was super fun, and then, like, you walk through it, and she walked us through the first couple scenes, and then she took off for a while.
Yeah.
But you'd walk through, and there were, like, these really great kind of mannequins. I don't want to say mannequins, because that makes it sound cheap.
No, because
it was actually
they were
very well set up.
They were, like, they were animatronic. So it's kind of the way I was describing it to my parents, mm-hmm. Is if you go to Disneyland, it was kind of like a Fantasyland ride in Disneyland that, mm-hmm. you walked through.
Yeah, it was like there were all these figures that were telling a story. And you'd get the information in your earpiece, but then there'd also be music and lights and things that would happen along with...
It was a full experience.
Oh, totally. And you walked along and you'd walk into a room, and it would be like, now the butcher is talking about his story, and you'd get his story about it. And one thing I didn't realize about Canterbury Tales is how kind of blue and, like, vulgar
it was. Oh, it's really vulgar.
Which was funny. I had no idea.
Yeah. No, and that was what was great about it, is you really experienced, mm-hmm. them. And, like, I love to read, but I'm never going to sit down and read Canterbury Tales.
I think it's a thing that for us now, you know, like a TV adaptation or something like that is more useful to us, because obviously we don't read Middle English.
Well, and that's the thing, is I think even if I tried to read Canterbury Tales, I wouldn't get enough out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
although I'm just curious, do you enjoy reading Shakespeare?
I do love reading Shakespeare.
I also love reading Shakespeare, and it's kind of like, it's a bit of a puzzle.
Well, and I, to be honest, I love reading Shakespeare for school, too, because I love the discussions that you have on it.
You know what I love most about Shakespeare is I love seeing somebody act Shakespeare really well.
Me, too.
Because to be able to act Shakespeare well is, like, a gift. But, like, to see somebody trying to act Shakespeare and only reciting lines...
Oh, it's so bad, because it's like, how do I compare thee? And
but if you can get into it and act like that's how you actually speak, it's amazing.
That's actually one of the reasons why I love Bard on the Beach. Is
I've never been.
Oh, the quality of Bard. I'm going to try to get a discount through work. To go. Because we should go. If you go to the matinees, it's not that expensive either. So we should go to a matinee performance of Bard on the Beach, because the quality is just incredible.
I mean, it definitely can be really awesome to see these kinds of, you know, narratives or plays to immerse yourself in how people used to speak, right? Like, it really does transport you into a different time, but it also can be really hard to relate to it.
Yeah.
And this attraction did a really good job of being very of the time, but then also being humorous and funny and... vulgar and ridiculous, and like it was really fun.
Well, and nobody really liked it. Nobody leaves character. You go into the gift shop at the end, and even in the gift shop, they're full on in character.
Yeah, it was super cool. I mean, I think for what we paid, it was super worth it, and I felt like I gained a lot more knowledge about what the Canterbury Tales were about.
Exactly. No, I thought it was really worth it, and it was like an hour, I think, in total, like, because it was about a 45-minute
trip. It's like, I can't even picture how we managed to walk around this one church space that seemed... They split it up and designed the place really well.
They designed it really well, and they have the actress come in and out. Like, she's only in at the beginning and the end.
Yeah, and then she shows up again, and she's like, oh, pilgrims, you're over here. Let me bring you over here, and then we'll tell you another story. But you still have somebody interacting with you, and it's really cool.
The way they did the blend of, like, going on your own with her, and it's just that full experience, too, like, because when you go in to the... the lobby and having the guy who's like fully in costume, fully in character, it just all came together in a beautiful way. Canterbury to London.
We also ate Mexican food in Canterbury.
Oh, it was delicious.
It was fucking delicious.
It was so good. So good. It was like one of our best meals.
Yeah.
It was so good. And the girls were so awesome. Well, they were like us. They were like colored hair, like cool historian type people. And then they were flirting with like the boys in front of us, and it was really adorable.
So one thing I remember from being in Canterbury Cathedral, and as I've probably mentioned before, and Aaron knows, I am a sucker for a church gift shop.
Oh, yeah.
Because I collect religious memorabilia. And so we were in this one kind of side gift shop in Canterbury Cathedral, and they had what looked like rosaries. And I asked the lady, and I was like, okay, so this is an Anglican church.
Yeah.
Which is a Protestant church. And she's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, but you have rosaries.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so do Anglicans have rosaries? Because I was just like, I'm just kind of confused.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, well, we actually have, like, prayer beads or something that have different... Because the Anglican church is very Catholic in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. It's essentially...
Because it still follows... I mean, they still have bishops and dioceses and cathedrals and things that are, like, typically very Catholic. So I was just asking her, I was like, do Anglicans also have rosaries? And she's like, well, not really. We have prayer beads that have a different number of beads. And I said, oh, is that what these are? These Anglican prayer beads? She's like, no, those are just rosaries. We just sell them to make money. And I was like, like, I kind of regret not getting one now, because now I think it's funny. But at the time, I was like... That just doesn't seem authentic.
I can't do it.
But, like, now, in hindsight, I'm like, I should have got one, because I think it's really funny.
Their gift shop was hilarious, like, because that is the one where I got the lip gloss.
And the lip gloss and the boring postcard.
I still love that. It's not boring, Erin.
And also, one interesting thing that I noticed, like, they had Green Man.
I bought
a Green Man shirt. The Green Man is a very pagan Celtic figure who's like the Lord of the Forest, and that's one thing that I've always really loved about UK Christianity is that they really incorporated a lot of British paganism into their religion, depending on the area. And, like, they just kind of learned that if they just kind of folded some of the paganism into their beliefs, that it was easier to get people to buy into the Christianity.
Yeah.
And so it was really cool to go into, you know, the main number one church of the Anglican faith and see Green Man stuff, which is a very pagan thing.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of cool and interesting. And I guess they have some, like, Green Man carvings in parts of the church, which I didn't see, but that's what I...
Yeah, apparently, like, some of the... And I think it's actually...
Might have been covered by some of the
scaffolding. Yeah, because I think it's actually some of the peaks of the fan vaulting have Green Men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish I would have seen that.
Well, we're just going to have to get back, Rachel.
So, I think that pretty much wraps up what we have to say about Canterbury as being a really lovely town.
It was quaint. It was beautiful. We want to live there. We loved the river. We loved the tales. We loved everything. There's
some very lovely, cute cemeteries.
We went to that, it was like the Sailor Bar, too. Went there. It's really hard to find a place to go for a drink in Canterbury.
We got there early, so it was like 11:45, and everyone was like, everywhere was closed.
We're like, hi! And they're like, oh, no, we don't open till 1.
But the funny thing is like, if here, I feel like if you went somewhere at 11:50 and they were almost open or not open, they'd be like, yeah, come on in.
Just sit.
But there, they're just like, no, we're closed. Bye.
And you're like, oh.
We're relaxed and we're not open, so go away.
You'd walk in, they were just chatting with each other, too. Yeah. It wasn't like they were setting up, they were all just chatting.
Yeah. Yeah, so we took the train back to London, and we went to the Harry Potter store, and we bought a lot of stuff, and...
I love my Time Turner.
You got your Time Turner necklace. I bought some shirts and some earrings and some lovely things.
And all of our like, Slytherin Ravenclaw stuff. Slytherclaw.
Yeah, so I have identified with being a Ravenclaw for a long time.
Me too.
And I still do. Mm-hmm. But I did... He seemed like it was, like, a more recent quiz.
Oh, yeah.
I did it, and I came out Slytherin.
Oh.
I came out Slytherin-Ravenclaw as opposed to being Ravenclaw-Slytherin.
Interesting.
And I'm actually okay with that.
Well, see, because I think... Well, we were having this discussion, whereas I'm like, I'm a Ravenclaw with Slytherin tendencies.
I think I'm pretty 50-50 on the Ravenclaw Slytherin. I mean, I don't know what you call it when you're a Ravenclaw first, because Raven-in doesn't work as well as Slytherclaw.
No, you're a Slytherclaw no matter what, I feel.
I'm a Slytherclaw. Slytherclaw just sounds better than Raven.
Raven-in. Raven-in.
Doesn't really work.
No, so you're a Slytherclaw. Yeah. We're both Slytherclaws.
Yeah.
I
have a love-hate relationship with London, I have to say.
I love it, and I hate it. Yeah, no, exactly.
I don't want to live there at all.
I don't want to live there at all.
Unless I have a really good job.
But that's the thing is, like, your good job has to pay you so much. Because London is the same amount in... If you look at London pricing, it's the same as you see in Canadian dollars, but it's in pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But in London, you typically make similar salaries to what you make in Canada. Because you make, like, you know, 100K is sort of the top that you can get.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or one of the top salaries here. And, mm-hmm. like, people make above that. But it's, like, 50,000 pounds to 75,000 pounds is common in London. That's the same as that. I don't know how the fuck you survive on that in London.
Everyone who I've ever known that's lived in London is just scraping by.
Yeah. Well, I know a few people who did well, but I'm just like, even then, like, that's just because you're single and don't have kids.
I just feel like there's other places in England that are also expensive, but less expensive, that are also lovely and less crazy than London.
People walked into you all the time.
I know. That was a weird thing. And my cousin Charlotte, who lives there, agreed. Because we were like, man, people just walk directly fucking into you all the time.
Yeah.
And she was like, I know. It was so weird when I moved here. I noticed that. It's like, they'll look at you and there's no one else on the sidewalk and they still walk right into you.
Yeah.
What the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah. Like, and it just didn't make any sense, especially because, like, they all queue. Like, that was the one thing that I loved about coming back to England after being in Eastern Europe is I was like, everybody queues. This is great. And also coming back to Canada after I was like, ugh, why can't we queue?
Yeah, I feel like what people didn't do that in France. So if we're going to talk about our whole trip, which was awesome.
Yes.
So to recap, we flew into London.
We flew into London.
We went to Paris. We spent a week in Paris.
Oh my God. Yeah.
We spent a couple days in Prague.
Yeah.
We took the train to Ljubljana. We were there for a few days and had colds.
Yeah.
We went to Budapest for a few days. We flew back to London. We went to London for a couple days. We spent a day in Paris or in Canterbury.
Yeah.
So any final thoughts on like favorite things or disappointing things or anything?
Prague was the interesting one for me in that I've wanted to go to Prague for so long. Mm-hmm. I think it's still a beautiful city. I think it was incredible, but the whole touristy nature of Prague really sort of turned me off. And so I was kind of disappointed by Prague.
Especially the way that they bank so heavily on the touristiness of the center of the city, but you know anything outside of the center of the city is like pretty trashy.
Yeah, pretty trashy, pretty
no
sketchy.
No offense, Prague, but like...
Well, and I just found everybody was quite rude to you in Prague, too.
Yeah, well, a number of our customer service people were not... I mean, it's different than here, like in Canada or in America, where it's known that you go out of your way to be like, how can I help you? What's going on? Like, places we went in Europe, people would be more like... You know, you'd be like, oh, can I get this? And they're like, yeah, it's right over there.
Yeah.
Like, go help yourself.
Yeah.
And it's just less kind of like you're not there to help the customer. They're there to ask you, but, like, you're going to give them the bare minimum.
Yeah, exactly.
I just feel like that's kind of the way it is in some European countries.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, like... People are all different, so maybe we got bad people on bad days.
Exactly. That could have been it.
But we certainly in Prague got some very cranky, unhelpful people.
Definitely.
But I've talked to other people who said that they had the opposite experience there.
So, you know, it could have just been the when we went. Our cab driver was great when we were in Prague, too.
The one that picked us up from the airport?
Yeah.
He was okay.
I guess I was just like, you're not a complete scam artist, therefore you're great.
I know, I'm always scared when I'm taking services like that.
Yeah, especially in Eastern Europe.
I personally loved Paris.
I loved Paris. And that's actually what I was thinking is I was like, so in terms of like an all-inclusive, like...
Wonderful experience.
I think Paris was that for
me. Like if I said you could only pick one city to be in on that trip.
Oh, I think there's just so much
it's
to Paris.
Hard, though, it's hard. Budapest was also great. For me, it's no question Paris.
Yeah, and it's tough for me. Budapest was so full of unique experiences.
Absolutely.
I have the advantage on you that I'd been to Paris before.
But like a long time ago.
I was 16 when I was in Paris. And so, also, it was really great for us. So we had, as we've talked about, we had this Airbnb in Montmartre. It really felt like we lived in Paris.
I loved it.
I loved it. And so I think...
I still want to live there.
I so want to live there. That... the week like, we spent in Paris
Budapest was really cool, but I don't know if I'd want to live in Budapest. I don't know if I want to live in any of the other places that we went. But Paris, I could picture myself living there.
That was the same thing with me is, I think with Budapest, it's like, it's sort of like how I feel about Thailand is I love Thailand. It's probably one of my favorite places that I've ever been in my life. I don't want to live there.
Yeah.
Budapest, same thing. I loved it. I need to go back to Budapest.
But I think it's great for us because we come from a place like Vancouver where we, you know, make enough money to survive here.
Mm-hmm.
But there, it's so cheap because the people that live there make such a low living wage.
Oh, I felt so rich in Budapest.
Exactly. So you don't want to live there because you wouldn't make very much money.
Yeah,
and
but
I feel
you
like
travel
Paris
there.
Is probably comparable to Vancouver.
Yeah, I think so. It's not London crazy. It's not London crazy. Well, we were looking because we both got when we were in Europe. We were like,
what's the rent like here?
The two places we really did it was Paris and Canterbury.
Yeah,
And Paris, like we didn't fully get into it, but we realized quite quickly we could afford to live in Paris.
Places that we live in here. But still, we could afford it.
But it wouldn't be like London, where we'd be living in like really
a shoe closet for $2,000
that's not even in the city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Under almost no circumstances would choose to personally live in London.
No, I'd love to live in smaller places. Like, I loved Canterbury. I've been to Oxford and Cambridge. I love them both dearly.
Well, you know how much I love Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So, I live in, there are lots of other cities in the UK, I'm sure, that I would love to live in.
I'd love to live near London, so that you could go in and see theater. Like,
I love the size of Vancouver, and London just feels so much crazier.
Okay, so we're talking about London, like, London is this giant city. Like, it is just so freaking giant.
I feel like you can't, if you love Europe and you go to Europe, you can't avoid London.
No, and like, but the one thing I've been thinking about recently, so we flew in and out of London because it was cheaper to fly in and out of London.
That was the cheapest flights that I found.
I know, and it makes sense, but the more I think about it, and like, you never think about these things until after you're back, because I'm like, it probably costs us more to stay in London than it did for the savings of flying in and out of London.
We came back to London, we had to stay in this fucking hostel, and it was the only time in our goddamn trip
we had
to stay in a hostel.
We had bunk beds!
We were so spoiled. Like, we went on this trip, we stayed in Airbnbs everywhere we went, like, amazing, wonderful, lovely Airbnbs.
For like $35 a night.
And, like, sure, we shared a queen-size bed most of the time, but that's totally fine. But we'd have, like, a whole apartment in, like, Paris and Prague, and even in Budapest, we had our own beds.
Yeah.
But then, because we didn't know exactly what was happening when we went back to London, and we stayed with my cousin Charlotte when we came in, but on the way back, her roommate was back. We couldn't stay with him. So we had to book a place. And the only place that I could book that was close-ish to where we were going to be that was, like, somewhat affordable and had a private room, because I'm not going to... I'm 33 years old. You're 35 years old. We are not going to sleep in a room with 12 other 17-year-olds.
Yeah, no, we're not up for that.
No. We booked a private room, and it was the most expensive place that we stayed.
$118 a night.
And it was, like, the shittiest, smallest, crappiest bunk beds.
So, it's quite entertaining, because it's right next to King's Cross. So, they play on the King's Cross theme, and so everything is designed as King's Cross. And I'm like, Rachel, we are literally in a cupboard under the stairs.
Yep.
So, we had bunk beds. And we were probably in a room that is slightly smaller than your bedroom that we're recording in right now.
Oh, God, no. Like,
it would be, like, right here.
We're in my bedroom right now. That room was, like, a third, maybe.
It was the size of...
It was tiny.
It was tiny, tiny, tiny.
It was what it was because we didn't know our accommodations, what was happening at the time, so...
Yeah.
I looked at Airbnbs, but they were all way more expensive, and it was...
Oh, and they were, like, out at, like, they were in the sub... Like, crazy into the suburbs, and when you're only there for one day, you don't want to be commuting in from them.
I mean, it was fine enough to go and fall asleep.
Yeah.
But it still was really irritating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's why I really heartfeltly say there are things I love about London, but fuck London.
Fuck London. Yeah, so I think Paris, Budapest, and Ljubljana. Well, I mean, that's half of our trip, but I think...
Paris for life, man.
Paris love for Paris. Life. Ljubljana, like, Slovenia in general is just a highlight because it's, like, this unique place. Lovely. That is Mediterranean.
Don't want to live there,
Europe.
Though.
Oh, it's too tiny.
No, too small.
Too small. But I'd love to go and visit all of Slovenia. Mm-hmm. Like, I love it. It's outdoorsy.
That's why you live in Paris, and then you go and visit all these lovely places.
Yeah. And because, like, I don't want to live in Budapest, but mm-hmm. I feel like we just touched on the surface of Budapest being there.
Budapest has a lot of cool stuff. It's also sketchy as fuck.
But yeah. But, like, I really want to go back. I don't want to live there, but I really want to go back. Paris is the only place that we went that I was like, I want to live.
Loved it.
I would love
Loved to... Loved every single minute of being in Paris.
Well, and now I'm rereading, or now that I'm reading Sacrebleu, and so it's set in Montmartre, and I'm just like, oh, I can picture all of this stuff, and I loved, like, in Paris, we could walk out, and we could just, like, go to the corner store that was also a bakery and also a place to get your groceries.
The baked goods were so good.
The baked goods were so good. And you could walk up to, like, there was these incredible farmers markets up by Sacre Coeur that you could go through.
And just, like, the art you could buy on the street.
Yeah, it was something just... Paris was so unique, and I feel like we didn't leave Montmartre that often other than to go to, like, tourist attractions in Paris, so we spent most of our time actually...
In the evenings we were in Montmartre.
And there's something just so authentic about Montmartre, and...
Yeah.
Like, and I know, like, it used to be, like, the very, like, sketchy side, but I love it. And it's very bohemian. It's very... It's sort of like what I want Mount Pleasant to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I listened to this podcast a while ago, and this is woman who used to be a journalist, and she wrote a book about how she moved to Paris and lives on the Rue des Martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just... She's just like, I love the street so much, because it's just like... cheese shops and wine shops and merchants and bookstores, and it's just like all these amazing little... I mean, how many times do we go past a store and we were like, oh my god, it looks amazing, we should go back tomorrow, but we couldn't find it, or we didn't go.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, we would just go past these places that all just look so... And they're so small. These, like, little storefronts.
Yeah. But I love that. But I don't like big, crowded stores. I hate big, crowded stores.
I mean, there was very little... I mean, we did go to an H&M, and we did go to Uniqlo, and...
Yeah.
But, like, Paris is more, especially Montmartre, is definitely more about, like, these little, tiny, like, hidden gems. I mean, I really feel like that's what Montmartre is about. It's a place of hidden gems.
Yeah, it really is. And...
And history. And art and individuality and... Like, I loved it.
I can't wait to go back. It was us, like, to be fair, like, where we stayed in Paris.
Couldn't have been happier with where we chose to stay.
Yeah, Montmartre was perfect for us. This trip was incredible.
I loved traveling with you.
I loved traveling with you.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
I can't wait until we do our next trip.
Me too.
It's going to be awesome.
We traveled so well together.
Yeah, so I think we should probably wrap up our...
As we just babble to everybody about how incredible our trip was.
Not every podcast episode is going to be so random and so weird as our travel at once, but if you have listened, thanks for listening, and I hope you learned something about all the cities that we went to.
And go
we
see
certainly
them.
Absolutely had a fabulous time, and it inspired us to do more art and more reading and more podcasting.
Yes.
So,
cheers to
traveling, and I love you, Erin.
I love you too. And that was literally one of the best 3 weeks of my life.